in. Welcome to minute 87 of season 10 of Mover, a minute, the daily podcast where we hijack our way through the 1974 classic thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Alex Marcus, the podcast director for PopBreak.com. Welcome back to the show, Alex.
Hey, Rob. Happy to be back for a second round.
Yeah. I hope you recovered from yesterday.
Yes, I'm rested and thirsted and ready to go.
Excellent. All right, so minute 87 begins with the old man continuing with his explanation and ends with the police car quickly turning around. So we ended things yesterday with the passengers on the train somewhat panicking that the train is not stopping, and we have this old man who's not an old man trying to explain to people why they don't have to worry about it or anything. And he got cut off yesterday when he was starting to say, he says they have something called, and then he gets stopped. He gets cut off. And the next word is stoppers or stickers or something like that. Or whenever a train goes by a red light, these things are meant to stop them. So first of all, I know that you live in the New York area. I think you're in New Jersey, but have you been on, like, have you traveled the New York train system in the past?
Yes, very often. I lived in New York for 4 years, so I was in the subway every day back then. And whenever I go back into the city, I end up taking the subway. So a lot of familiarity with the subway system of New York.
Was this movie nostalgic for you?
In a sense, it's, you know, the train cars look different from when I was on them. You know, the subway stations look a little bit different, but some of them look quite similar because that's kind of the beauty of Manhattan, is some of the things never change. So in a sense, there was some nostalgia there. I was mostly just thinking about, like, what I would do if I was stuck on a hijacked train and how that would go. Because that's, and that is something.
Don't get in the first car ever. Yeah, I think that's
yes. And listen, I never do. So I feel like I would probably be okay, because that's a good lesson. And you know, it's also really far to walk usually, because, you know, where they let you out of the subway, like at the center of the platform, you're usually in the middle of the train or maybe towards the end, but you're never at the front. So true. I feel like you really have to go out of your way to be in that car.
All right, that's understandable. Okay, are you familiar with the idea that this old man is talking about? With the stoppers or stickers or something?
So not specifically with the lights and you need to have a red light or a green light. I don't know if it still works that way or if that's no longer the case. But I'm not, pretty much my experience of the subway is you go into the subway and then into the doors and it closes, and then you get out in the spot where you're going. So okay. I'm not sure the mechanics of it. I did like the part where they were, like, in the beginning of the movie, we get a little bit of the training conductor, mm-hmm. who's learning, and he's trying to pass his test, and he talks about how, yes, they talk about how you have to, like, look and one way, close the door, look.
And make sure the train's not dragging anybody.
Yes. And that, actually, I was like, you know what? I'm glad that's part of their training, because I've actually seen that happen, like, once or twice. Nobody being dragged, necessarily. But, like, people try to, like, sneak in as the doors are closing, and they got a backpack on. And then suddenly their backpack is stuck in the door, and the train is starting to move, and they're, like, panicking. They're like, what am I going to do? I'm stuck in this backpack, and it's stuck in the door. And it's a very stressful moment. So it's nice to know that part of their training, at least back in the 70s, was to make sure that you don't actually move until that's fixed.
Okay, makes sense. So he mentioned something called a stopper. So I said, okay, I'm going to go look up what's a stopper. And I got a whole bunch of different options of what a stopper is. A stopper could be a plug used to stop the opening of a container, you know, like in a laboratory, you know, if you have like a beaker and stuff like that. You have a plug that's used to stop a drainage outlet in soccer, which is also in some places known as football. A defender is known as the stopper. You have a gun that's it's the Milker 37 millimeter gun, which is called a stopper. You have a whitewater hole. When you go through when you're kayaking and you hit an area that has a lot of white water, that's also known as a stopper. A local train that ends up stopping at every station, that's also known as a stopper. It's a term in the game of bridge. It's a baseball term for a key pitcher. It's also a slang for a stopwatch, which the idea of
Oh, sure.
measuring a small amount of time.
I
There's
can see that.
also a type of knot. You can do a stopper knot, which is a knot that you can put at the end of a rope. And so those are the stoppers. So I said, okay, he's wrong. It's not called the stopper. So I then did a little more research to find out what it actually is called. And it's actually called a trip cock, okay, which is also known as a tripper, which maybe that's why
Okay.
he thinks it's stickers, tripper. It's also known as a trip stop or a train stop. And what that is it's a train protection device that automatically stops a train if it attempts to pass a signal when the signal aspect and operating rules prohibit such movement, or if it attempts to pass an excessive speed. So it's basically this little box that's set in the ground that the whole idea is that when you go across it, it will make the train it'll trip the brakes basically. That's the idea of the whole thing.
Okay.
The truth is it's actually a very cool idea that they have things like this.
And
Someone
that's
actually
still in
thought about it.
effect now?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I guess I always assumed that they like must have switched to like a computer run like grid system at some point.
But you still have to have manual ways of stopping things in case something goes wrong.
Sure, that makes sense.
That's okay. I don't think that the whole idea of these trip cocks is something that they use all the time. It's there as a safety measure in case in case four random guys hijack a train and decide to just let it keep going as fast as possible and accelerating. Then you want to make sure that you have a trip cock that's going to work.
Sure.
Other than in most situations you don't need it,
But it is good to be prepared for that situation
that's right. It's like,
specifically.
come on,
'Cause I mean,
how often when you're driving do you ever use the emergency brake? You might use it
very,
when you park, but when you're driving,
yeah,
you don't use it. But
you should
it's
hope
there.
if you're driving how you're supposed to, you should use it almost never.
Right. And I think that's the idea here also. This is not something that that is meant to be used. It's meant to be there in order to stop it. But they actually set up a system in Boston in 1901, which was able to start stopping trains. Obviously, it's not the same sophistication of what they use now, but still, the fact that all the way back in 1901, they were thinking of, okay, let's find a way to make sure that these trains don't go, don't get out of hand, is pretty smart. Because I know that I'm trying to remember during the development of cars. They must have had to have a brake at the beginning, but there was something that they didn't have that they ended up adding. I'm trying to remember what it is. I can't think of it right now. But there's something like very important that we use in a car now that they didn't have. And I'm not talking about seat belts, because seat belts took a long time till they put in. But there's something in the mechanism of a car. I don't know. If I remember what it is, I'll. But yeah, it's something that. It's quite important to have. So this old guy is close, by calling it a stopper. It's funny that they do this because, anyone who's doing proper research, even back in 1974, would have just called it a, they would have called it a trip cock, and that would have been it. But to make it that you have someone who's familiar with the train system, and he's able to okay, I know it's something and. He's not 100% sure. That actually, to me, adds a lot more realism to the movie. Because here you have a typical commuter that knows there's something that's going to be able to stop this. During the course of the, I don't know, 40 years he's been traveling on the train, he knows that there is such a thing.
Yeah.
And
Does that add to the believability of it though? Because I feel like I feel like
it's a
that
way, well,
felt
no,
more like
it's a way to explain it to us.
It's definitely a good way of getting the exposition in, but I did think that it took me a little out of the movie to be honest. Like the ways in which they try to jam so much of the like this is how the subway works into the course of the story, I think it's better executed at the beginning when we're dealing with someone who is training to get, that's obviously like a very tired trope of like, oh, it's my first day on the job, so tell me everything I need to know, right? Like we've seen that in a million movies, but at least that's like a little bit more believable than just like, oh, this one random old man just happens to know how the subway works. Because like I could tell you, like if you live in New York City, you ride the subway all the time. No one is being like, and here's how we make sure that the car doesn't stop if it runs out of control. These are the safe. Like no one explains anything. There's no so like it would have meant that like this old man happened to have become friends with a conductor at some point who explained this to him, which I guess is like somewhat believable, but it mostly just feels like they needed the audience to hear that, and they just put it in the mouth of that old man
Well,
so that
they
way
wouldn't have been able to put it in Bud's mouth because Bud, when he was talking at the training at the beginning, it wouldn't have made any sense to talk about the fact that, and you got all the green lights,
correct.
that wouldn't have made sense. And there was
It
no
would
other.
have made more sense for someone in the like control room to drop that exposition, especially if they were conveying the information to like a police officer who's something like that, like, oh, like this is the safety mechanism that we have. But the downside of that is then the people inside the train are still kind of like in the dark, and you need to have a moment where they start to freak out and be like, oh no, like we're doing what they told us to do, but now we're alone and we're
Exactly.
going.
So they needed to do it.
But I kind of think that they should have trusted the audience a little bit and just been like, I don't know, if I was on a train car that was like going 70 miles an hour out of control, and the people who kidnapped me are nowhere to be found, I feel like that's enough to ratchet off the tension. I don't need the old man to say like, oh, you should listen to me. This is the safety mechanism, but oh no, the safety mechanism isn't working. Like, so I feel like that was a little clunky for me.
Okay, I mean, I like the way they did it because as you said, there's chaos and someone's trying to calm them down, and then it calms down the viewer also because like okay, we know that now that they have these stoppers or trip cocks or whatever it is that are gonna stop them, and then the next line of one of the characters, he goes, "There's just one thing, baby." He goes, "What's that?" "They're all green." So, that those lines wouldn't have worked if the exposition came from someone else. It had to have come from someone inside the train who's trying to reassure them, and then, okay, now we're back to the chaos.
Yeah, it's a minor nitpick. If we weren't talking about the film minute by minute, I probably wouldn't raise it. But for me, it does feel like a little bit taking me out of the movie to have the old man be like an expert on how trains stop.
Again, I don't have a problem with it because this is a guy who is clearly saying that he's a seasoned train rider, so he knows a lot, he knows more than your average train rider would know, and
Yeah,
he's trying to calm people down.
I almost wish it had instead been like he was a retired conductor who happened to be on the subway.
Well, the retired
And like,
conductor who's on the subway is Mr. Green, who
sure.
also blurts something out when he talks about the fact, he got written up for a ticket.
Yeah.
For passing
That
the
was
red
a funny moment.
yes.
Because like the whole thing is they're like concealing their identities, and now he's going to give this like anecdote about how he got in trouble at work that would have probably been easy to cross-reference later.
Easier today than in 1974, but still pretty easy,
Yeah.
right? And then the chaos continues. Everyone starts screaming. You even see the old man is now concerned. He was trying to calm them down, and then the look on his face is okay, something is worse than I thought. He was calm, and now he joins in, not being calm. And you see it in his eyes. You definitely can see it. And then they give us another POV of the train just barreling through the tracks. And then we're back to Garber and Daniels in the car, and they continue their conversation from what we talked about yesterday. And he goes, "Inspector, the short move they made between 28th Street and 17th Street, why'd they do that?" "I don't know." "Suppose you wanted to do something they wanted to do something that they didn't want anyone else to know about." "Like what?" Now, again, we talked a little bit about this yesterday. Julius
Yeah.
Harris is great in this role, but he's basically just there to to move along Garber's dialogue. You know,
Yes, it is
every one of
because.
them has is, you know, just one little one-liners. I don't know, like what?
They have, so in something that I like to watch, I grew up watching this. I watch it less now, but I grew up watching American soap operas, like daytime soap operas. And those, for people who are unaware, like they air 5 days a week, and there's like a bunch of different storylines, and they move at a pretty incremental pace. But they're designed, at least they were for a long time, to not necessarily be watched every single day, because like people are busy, right? They don't assume
Right.
that you're watching 5 hours of the same show every single day, like every single week. So things will happen, and then a couple of episodes later, they'll want the audience to be like caught up on what's happened a few days before, so that way you're making sure everyone knows what's going on at all times. And so there's always plot movers, like main characters, but then you have this like plot contrivance of what is often referred to as talk twos. It's like I'm like, so I have to go to this person, like my mother-in-law or like the neighbor, and I have to go and tell them what's happened. And so that way now the audience knows. And so they get stuck being a talk to. And our guy, the police officer in this movie, is very much serving as a talk to for Walter Matthau's character.
Yeah, for sure. And again, it works. It
Yeah,
works
because
because
you've got a great character actor who is giving as much as he possibly can without like trying to steal the scene. Like he knows this is Walter Matthau's scene, but he is so present in the moment and giving you so many fun reactions that it feels engaging and dynamic instead of just a person who is receiving exposition.
exactly. And then Garber goes like jumping off the train. And he goes, turn around, Inspector. We're going back to 17th Street. He goes, like hell we are. They're not on the train, I'm sure of it. Look, Garber, I suggested that in the first place, and you shot me down. Something about a dead man's feature. They figured out how to beat that. That's their plan. That's what they started with. And then Daniels thinks for a second. He goes, turn this thing around and burn rubber. You know, it's interesting the way that Garber's able to easily convince him with this whole thing. But again, as we mentioned a little bit yesterday, it's nice to see the way that we can see the plan form in Garber's mind. You know, Garber's trying to think out of the box. What could they have done? You know, how did they? You know, what's going on here? And you know, we know that they got off the train. We know that they have some sort of contraption. You know, but Garber doesn't. And I think that's really, really, really well done. The way that they're just giving us this little scene of exposition between these two characters that's, you know, you see the light bulb go off over Garber's head, and then at the end of this minute, you see the light bulb go off over over Daniels' head, where he's like, okay, maybe you're right.
Yeah,
So.
and I mean, I think I talked about this in yesterday's episode, but it is impressive that all that's really happening is Walter Matthau told us something can't happen, and then a few minutes later said, "Oh no, I think actually that thing that I said couldn't happen is what's happening." And then they have to just go back where they came from. That's like such a risky thing to put into a movie because all you're basically doing is delaying, right? You're getting to this point where it's like, okay, here, this is what I thought was going to happen. Oh, no, never mind. I was wrong. It's actually the other thing that I already said was going to happen.
But it's more than that.
The more
It's more
normal
than
thing
that.
to do is in that moment, the more traditional thing to do is to say like, oh, we thought it was this, but actually it's something different. You know, where it's like, oh, I thought that this was happening, but really there's something that we hadn't even considered that's happening. But instead, they do, I think, the braver thing, the more interesting thing, and say, like, oh, the thing that we just missed is actually the thing that actually is happening. It adds to that sort of the ongoing, like aura around these villains of they're taking advantage of the fact that you are underestimating them. You think that they don't know how the train works. You think that they don't have a plan, that they went into this without a clear exit plan, without like all this stuff, when actually they've thought through everything and they are really sophisticated and they have the inside information and they know exactly what to do and how to do it. So that like that makes them more compelling antagonists throughout. And so I think that that's necessary for them to have to be in that position for Walter Matthau to say like, oh, it's not this. Oh, it was that. But it's a tricky thing to pull off, and I think it's really well executed.
I agree with you on that, but you know the part of the whole thing here though is that they explain to us why it's impossible, and then we see the villains show us that it is possible, that they figured out a way around it. And then, you know, so it doesn't completely negate everything that Garber said before. Garber said it's impossible. And then we see, okay, it's normally impossible, and then now they have something new. And here he's, when he's trying to figure out what their plan is, so then it hits him and says, wait a second, maybe I need to think of this differently. I know that something is impossible, but you know, maybe they figured out a way to make that possible. And that's literally what happened here. So I like the way that they did that. Now I've asked a lot of my guests this question, and we'll never know the true answer. But do you believe that Mr. Blue set up this entire heist on his own, or was he hired by somebody, you know, to get these guys together and do this heist? For instance, I mean, we'll go back to Tarantino. You know, you have Marcellus Wallace, you have Joe. You know, you have people that are behind the scenes that are putting together these teams to go do heists. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's an unknowable answer, right? But or an unknowable question. But I do think that the way that I felt watching it was that they were all working for someone else, that there was a puppet master pulling the strings, and that our Robert Shaw character, Mr. Blue, he was hired to be the ringleader, the guy who like set up the strategy and knew how to make sure that the plan was executed well. But there's something about the people that are recruited in addition to him that makes me feel like he didn't choose the crew. It feels like if he had, he would have maybe not necessarily chosen our guy who kind of goes rogue,
he
right?
Wouldn't have taken Mr. Gray, for sure not.
Yeah, and I don't know if he even would have chosen that particular train conductor. Maybe he would have had to have, the retired train conductor, because that was just the best option that they had. But he also doesn't really seem quite the caliber of the man that Robert Shaw's character would have wanted to have on the team. So I feel like he is the one who has been put in charge but has not brought this team together, and therefore that would mean that there has to be someone else.
Right. Okay, that's my conclusion also, that there's definitely someone else. That's behind.
But now I have a question for you. I mean, not to spoil the end of the film, is it okay if I talk about how this ends, or no?
Sure.
We want to save
that. Okay. My assumption is anyone who's listening to this has seen the movie and knows what's going to happen at the end.
It would be interesting to be a listener who is trying to watch along but stops at the end of every minute the end of your coverage. But I mean, I'd love to hear from that person and what their experience is like. But in any case, so. The way that the film ends, you don't get resolution on that question at all, right?
No.
You don't. And so if you, like me, think that there was a puppet master behind the scenes, is any part of you frustrated to not get to know anything about that person by the time the film ends?
Well, again, the fact that they were able to finally capture Mr. Green, my assumption is that he spilled the beans. So
sure.
If there was a puppet master, he was trying to save himself by giving away who the puppet master is.
Yeah.
That would be my explanation to the whole thing, because he's
so that's again, and that's enough for you.
Yeah,
you don't feel like you need to know anything about the guy yourself. You just need to know that, like, eventually, it seems like that guy's going to be brought to justice. Probably, given the one person who it was left standing is the one person who's least able to keep his to keep that together and not get caught.
Well, because he's also the one who's not a criminal,
right?
You know, he's the technical guy that they needed. You know, in a movie today, this would be the you know, the programmer that they need. You know, not someone who's a criminal. You know, they needed a guy who could drive a train. That's what it comes down to. And they said, okay, you know, we know this guy that you know, that got into trouble, and so okay, we'll use him. You know, that's it. I think that's where things would have gone from that point.
Makes sense.
That would be my explanation. So I actually started doing a little bit of research on what's known as train surfing. You know, which basically means people riding on the outside of a train. Okay, and so the two things that I found interesting was, first of all, there are five very dangerous aspects of train surfing. One of them is that you can get easily electrocuted because the tracks are electrified. And if you happen to come in contact with any of them, if you fall or anything like that, the odds are not good you're going to survive. You have clearance risks. which we see in a lot of movies. Someone stands a little too high up while the train's going. They go into a tunnel, and they get knocked off because of that. You have what's known as pinching and crushing. Sometimes the space between the train cars is very, very close. So if you're on the side of a train or something like that, you can easily get hit by another train that's going very close. There's certain places where there's a wide berth between the two, and certain places where it's just mere inches. The idea of unstable surfaces, that the exterior surfaces of trains are not designed for people to actually be on them. So it's possible that it can be very slippery and you can lose your balance very easily. And the obvious the biggest danger is the high speed movement. Because they're traveling at high speeds, there's wind forces and things like that that people can easily get knocked off of them. So, you and I have probably seen many movies where people are on top of trains, and every one of those
Yes.
aspects clearly rings true and sometimes is actually used to the advantage of of the good guy.
It's basically a checklist that every single train set action set piece I've ever seen hits, I think, at least four of those.
Exactly.
Do you have a favorite that comes to mind?
The one that jumps out at me now, I can't say it's my favorite, but the one that jumps out of my mind right now is Narrow Margin, which you by your silence, I don't think you know what Narrow Margin is.
No, I've not heard of that.
It's a movie from 1991 with Gene Hackman, where
Okay.
he has to get Ann Archer to safety. She's like a witness, and they're traveling on a train. And there are people on the train that are trying to stop them, and the climax of the movie takes place on top of the train.
Ah, okay. Very cool. Yeah, no, I've never heard of that, but that's exciting. I'm gonna go with the more a less exciting answer, but it is the one that comes to mind first. It's in The
Mission
Wolverine.
Impossible.
No, Mission Impossible has a couple of iconic ones on top of
Yeah.
trains, but for me, there's an action set piece at like the halfway point of the film The Wolverine, which came out in 2013, which is sort of like the unsung like Hugh Jackman Wolverine spin-off movie. Like everyone knows Logan, and then everyone knows X-Men Origins Wolverine for being terrible, but the one that came out in between those two, The Wolverine, which is set in Japan, has this like very, very fun set piece on top of a bullet train where like Logan is like having to hold on to the top of the train with his claws, and like he's trying to and he's fighting ninjas who are like with the mob or whatever. It's very fun. It's comic booky, but it's like a very good use of a super fast moving train.
Okay, that's a I knew you would go with the superhero aspect of it anyway. Why
Listen, I have a
does
brand
that
to
not
maintain.
surprise you? Exactly. How much do you think it what do you think the fine is for subway surfing?
Oh man, I mean, I would say probably like $150 fine.
It's up to 3 months in jail or $500 fine.
$500 fine. Okay. I feel like that's the sort of thing that it's like it's so stupid and dangerous, and you will almost certainly get severely injured by doing it, that it's almost superfluous to fine someone for doing it, but it should be illegal. I agree with that.
So the data that I was able to find, and I didn't go too far into it, but was from the early 2000s. So in 2002, there were 86 incidents of them catching people riding atop a stride or between subway cars, and in 2003, there were 60. So the number went down a little bit. Again, I don't know what it is in
That's
2025, but that's still
far too high. That's far too high.
yes, it is.
And
Yes,
listen,
it is.
there's literally so I found out not too long ago that the New York City public transit system accounts for, I believe it's a fourth of all like transit stops or riders. Yeah, like a fourth of all transit riders in the entire country are in the New York City public transit system. So you're dealing with a lot of people going on and off of your train cars, a tremendous amount. It's literally like tens of millions, because millions of people multiple times a day, right? Basically is what you're dealing with. So out of that pool, only 60 is actually pretty low from like a percentage standpoint, but from like a reality standpoint, that still seems way too high.
It really does.
We should be, as a society, we should be shooting for under 10 people riding on top of the subway in a year. I feel like that should be our target.
Yeah, probably. I would agree with that. And that's how this minute ends. So is there anything else you wanted to add about this particular minute?
No, I mean, again, we're just like we're ratcheting up the tension where the train is now out of control. The people in the inside of the car are really having a tough time. I like the use. I think that they make good geographic use of New York City because for somebody who doesn't know New York City, you might not realize how small it is actually. You know, I mean, most people who are moving through the city, you're on a train, you're walking, you're on a bike, whatever. But if you're actually in a car and that car is not being prevented from moving by with traffic, which a police car is not necessarily going to have traffic to worry about, especially in this situation where they know what's going on, they have like streets locked down and stuff. You can get back and forth from like 28th Street to like Astor Place, wherever they're going back and forth. You can get back and forth pretty fast. So I do think that they managed to use that to their advantage by having that moment where they're like having to turn around and still get back. And it's not like adding a tremendous amount of time to the emergency situation. Doesn't feel like they're like doing any shortcuts to make up the difference of time from going in one direction and back to the other. It feels like a really good use of that geography.
Yeah, I
But
definitely
that's
agree
just
with that.
like New York City nerd note to include.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. All right. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Blues Day Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five Robert Shaw performances. So once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Yeah, so unfortunately, and I did warn you this ahead of time, Robert Shaw is a bit of a blind spot for me, and a lot of the stuff that he has done, I haven't seen in a long time. So I'm only going to give a top three if that's okay.
Sure.
And my number three is going to be The Taking of Pelham 123, because I think he's doing a really tremendous job here in this film, doing a very minimal performance that really stands out. It really has to do, it has to make the most of, like everyone in this film, to be quite honest, has to make the most of very limited screen time. And I think he does that in the role of Mr. Blue. He has such command of that train. You feel like you know that he knows exactly what is happening, when it's happening, why it's happening, and what the next step is every step of the way until the very end. And I really think that there's just such a presence to him. And without there being like a menace, like he's not over the top in his like villainy or anything like that. He's just a calm, cool, collected guy who has a plan. He's going to execute that plan. And I think that it really is a fun like dynamic that he builds through the phone with him and Walter Matthau. So for me, I think Taking Pelham 123 deserves to be on the list of his best performances.
Okay, great.
My number two would be A Man of All Seasons, which is probably his most famous role, most, in terms of prestige, right? We're talking about a film that won Best Picture, the Oscars, back in 1966. It is a classic story. It's the Henry VIII story of creating the Church of England, a real historical epic. And, for fan, I grew up as a fan of The Tudors, the really trashy Showtime show about this. This take story, this version of the story, a little bit of a different vibe. But as we talk, we're talking about remakes in a way. It's a spiritual remake, right, of that. So, but I think it's the sort of thing that you want a respected British actor to put out is you want him to have that one historical epic in his resume. And I think this is rightfully a good candidate for that slot. So I'd give it to him for that. And then number one, I mean, I feel like it's just the obvious answer. Maybe it's not the coolest answer, but it's Jaws, right? Like that is the iconic Robert Shaw performance. That is the iconic Robert Shaw film. That it's film history. It's the original blockbuster. It still is part of the conversation 50 years later. And it's just iconic cinema. And he is a huge part of why that is the case. Like the main ensemble here, there's a lot of different personalities at play, a lot of different like things coming together. And ultimately, like what everyone says when they watch Jaws for the first time is, wow, that actually is a lot more of like a drama than I expected it to be. I thought it was gonna be like a fun, like slasher, like scary, like shark movie, but really it's like a heart of it is like a true dramatic film with like real stakes and real emotions. And he's such a huge part of why. And so he's an essential part of film history just for Jaws. So I think it has to be number one.
Okay, perfect. All right, and once again, we will play the daily game of Name That Remake. So we will spin the wheel, and the wheel goes around and around and around, and let's see where it'll stop, and see if Alex knows what movie this is. Okay. All right, so the original movie came out in 1939, and the remake came out in 1992, and it's about a man who decides that he wants to change things and goes into politics.
I'm gonna need more. Can I have another hint?
Okay, he runs for Congress.
Is they didn't remake Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, did they?
Are you sure?
Is okay, is that did they? That's my guess. Mr.
Okay.
Smith Goes to Washington?
Yes, it is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and the remake is The Distinguished Gentleman with Eddie Murphy from 1992.
What? Wait, Eddie Murphy remade Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in 1992?
Well, he did it a little differently. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the whole idea is it's about this guy who's pure and wants to make changes and stuff like that. The Distinguished Gentleman, he's a con man who decides
Okay.
to run for Congress based on name recognition and trying to change things. And while he's there, he actually realizes that he can actually do some real good there.
Wow, that's shocking. I have never heard of that film. That is wild. I thank you so much for bringing that into my life. I have to watch that immediately now.
It's nowhere near as good as Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
But I
Don't
that sounds
expect
like
that
the
for a
fact that that
second.
happened. I like need to know what that is now. So
Yeah.
that's such a
Okay.
wild thing. I can't
Okay.
believe that that's not something that we're always talking about. That he did that. That Eddie Murphy at the peak of his fame, like remade Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but made him a con man. That's crazy.
It's quite funny. It's one of it's one of Eddie Murphy's last great fun movies. He didn't
Wow.
have that
No
much of a,
respect
he didn't have
for.
a very large window of fun movies, like
Just
from
no respect for the
82 and then.
Shrek movies, man. That's tough.
But those aren't Eddie Murphy movies.
Well, they taught generations of people what's great about Eddie Murphy, so.
That is true, but they're not Eddie Murphy movies. Those are Mike Myers movies. Exactly. All right. So, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Blue Sky at Alex Marcus. You can follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow all the work that I do for The Pop Break by going to thepopbreak.com. Click on the podcast tab. You'll see all the podcasts that I supervise, all the podcasts that I co-host and appear on, including Bill versus the MCU, which is my monthly Marvel podcast, where we run through all of the highs and lows of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the tangentially related Marvel content, like Marvel's Defenders saga from Netflix, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the X-Men franchise, the assorted films of the Marvel Entertainment era, like Blade trilogy and the Fantastic Four films. And this fall, we're covering Marvel's animated slate from the last like 10 years or so, including the What If season 1, 2, and 3, Hitmonkey season 1 and 2, MODOK, that thing that totally exists and includes Jon Hamm as Iron Man, and then of course their most recent stuff that's been exclusive to Disney Plus, like Your Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, Eyes of Wakanda, and Marvel Zombies.
All
You can
right.
also follow my other podcast. It's Tomplicated, a Tom Holland podcast. We put out two episodes every month covering the entire filmography of Tom Holland. Me and my co-host Manish Mathur, we do one episode, we do one film, one television show, or one screen or stage performance, viral sensation per episode. It's really fun. We have some guests on, and it's a really great time. So if you like the films of Tom Holland, you should definitely check it out.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierop.net. So until tomorrow, chew.
Gesundheit.